And one of these arguments, in which Katavasov had obviously considered that he came off victorious, was the first thing Levin thought of as he recognized him. "No, whatever I do, I won't argue and give utterance to my ideas lightly," he thought. Getting out of the wagonette and greeting his brother and Katavasov, Levin asked about his wife. "She has taken Mattia to Kolok, a copse near the house. She meant to have him out there because it's so hot indoors," said Dolly. Levin had always advised his wife not to take the baby to the wood, thinking it unsafe, and he was not pleased to hear this. "She rushes about from place to place with him," said the prince, smiling. "I advised her to try putting him in the ice house. She meant to come to the apiary. She thought you would be there." "We are going there," said Dolly. "Well, and what are you doing?" said Sergei Ivanovich, falling back from the rest and walking beside him. "Oh, nothing special. Busy as usual with the land," answered Levin. "Well, and what about you? Come for long? We have been expecting you for such a long time." "Only for a fortnight. I've a great deal to do in Moscow." At these words, the brothers' eyes met, and Levin, in spite of the desire he always had, stronger than ever just now, to be on affectionate and still more open terms with his brother, felt an awkwardness in looking at him. He dropped his eyes and did not know what to say. Casting over the subjects of conversation that would be pleasant to Sergei Ivanovich and would keep him off the subject of the Servian War and the Slavonic question, at which he had hinted by alluding to what he had to do in Moscow, Levin began to talk of Sergei Ivanovich's book. "Well, have there been any reviews of your book?" he asked. Sergei Ivanovich smiled at the intentional character of the question. "No one is interested in that now, and I least of all," he said. "Just look, Darya Alexandrovna, we shall have a shower," he added, pointing with a sunshade at the white rain clouds that showed above the aspen treetops. And these words were enough to reestablish again between the brothers that tone, hardly hostile but chilly, which Levin had been so longing to avoid. Levin went up to Katavasov. "It was jolly of you to make up your mind to come," he said to him. "I've been intending to a long while. Now we shall have some discussion. We'll see to that. Have you been reading Spencer?" "No, I've not finished reading him," said Levin, "but I don't need him now." "How's that? That's interesting. Why so?" "I mean that I'm fully convinced that the solution of the problems that interest me I shall never find in him and his like. Now..." But Katavasov's serene and good-humored expression suddenly struck him, and he felt such tenderness for his own happy mood, which he was unmistakably disturbing by this conversation, that he remembered his resolution and stopped short. "But we'll talk later on it," he added. "If we're going to the apiary, it's this way along this little path," he said, addressing them all. Going along the narrow path to a little uncut meadow covered on one side with thick clumps of brilliant heartsease, among which stood up here and there tall, dark green tufts of hellebore, Levin settled his guests in the dense, cool shade of the young aspens on a bench, and some stumps purposely put there for visitors to the apiary who might be afraid of the bees. And he went off himself to the hut to get bread, cucumbers, and fresh honey to regale them with. Trying to make his movements as deliberate as possible, and listening to the bees that buzzed more and more frequently past him, he walked along the little path to the hut. In the very entry, one bee hummed angrily, caught in his beard, but he carefully extricated it. Going into the shady outer room, he took down from the wall his veil that hung on a peg, and putting it on, and thrusting his hands into his pockets, he went into the fenced-in bee garden, where there stood in the midst of a closely mown space in regular rows, fastened with fast on posts, all the hives he knew so well, the old stocks, each with its own history, and along the fences the younger swarms hived that year. In front of the openings of the hives, it made his eyes giddy to watch the bees and drones whirling round and round about the same spot, while among them the worker bees flew in and out with spoils, or in search of them, always in the same direction, into the wood, to the flowering linden trees, and back to the hives. His ears were filled with the incessant hum in various notes, Now the busy hum of the worker bee flying quickly off, then the blaring of the lazy drone, and the excited buzz of the bees on guard, protecting their property from the enemy and preparing to sting. On the farther side of the fence, the old beekeeper was shaving a hoop for a tub, and he did not see Levin. Levin stood still in the midst of the apiary and did not call him. He was glad of a chance to be alone, to recover from the influence of ordinary actual life, which had already depressed his happy mood. He thought that he had already had time to lose his temper with Ivan, to show coolness to his brother, and to talk flippantly with Katavasov. Can it have been only a momentary mood, and will it pass and leave no trace, he thought. But the same instant, going back to his mood, he felt with delight that something new and important had happened to him. Real life had only for a time overcast the spiritual peace he had found, but it was still untouched within him. Just as the bees whirling round him, now menacing him and distracting his attention, prevented him from enjoying a complete physical peace, forced him to restrain his movements to avoid them, so had the petty cares that had swarmed about him from the moment he got into the trap restricted his spiritual freedom, but that lasted only so long as he was among them. Just as his bodily strength was still unaffected in spite of the bees, so too was the spiritual strength that he had just become aware of. Chapter 15. Do you know Kostya, with whom Sergei Ivanovich traveled on his way here? Said Dolly, doling out cucumbers and honey to the children. With Vronsky. He's going to Serbia. And not alone, he's taking a squadron out with him at his own expense, said Katavasov. That's the right thing for him, said Levin. Are volunteers still going out then? He added, glancing at Sergei Ivanovich. Sergei Ivanovich did not answer. He was carefully, with a blunt knife, getting a live bee covered with sticky honey out of a cup full of white honeycomb. I should think so. You should have seen what was going on at the station yesterday, said Katavasov, biting with a succulent sound into a cucumber. Well, what is one to make of it? In Christ's name, do explain to me, Sergei Ivanovich, where are all those volunteers going? Whom are they fighting with? Asked the old prince, unmistakably taking up a conversation that had sprung up in Levin's absence. With the Turks, Sergei Ivanovich answered, smiling serenely as he extricated the bee, dark with honey and helplessly kicking, and transferred it with the knife to a stout aspen leaf. But who has declared war on the Turks? Ivan Ivanovich Regazov and Countess Lydia Ivanovna, assisted by Madame Stahl? No one has declared war, but people sympathize with their neighbor's suffering and are eager to help them, said Sergei Ivanovich. But the prince is not speaking of help, said Levin, coming to the assistance of his father-in-law, but of war. The prince says that private persons cannot take part in war without the permission of the government. Kostya, mind, that's a bee. Really, they'll sting us, said Dolly, waving away a wasp. But that's not a bee, it's a wasp, said Levin. Well, what's your own theory? Katavasov said to Levin with a smile, distinctly challenging him to a discussion. Why haven't private persons the right to do so? Oh, my theory's this. War is on one side such a beastly, cruel, and awful thing that no one man, not to speak of a Christian, can individually take upon himself the responsibility of beginning wars. That can only be done by a government, which is called upon to do this, and is driven inevitably into war. On the other hand, both political science and common sense teach us that in matters of state, and especially in the matter of war, private citizens must forego their personal individual will. Sergei Ivanovich and Katavasov had their replies ready, and both began speaking at the same time. But the point is, my dear fellow, that there may be cases when the government does not carry out the will of the citizens, and then the public asserts its will, said Katavasov. But evidently, Sergei Ivanovich did not approve of this answer. His brows contracted at Katavasov's words, and he said something else. You don't put the matter in its true light. There is no question here of a declaration of war, but simply the expression of a human Christian feeling. Our brothers, one with us in religion and in race, are being massacred, even supposing they were not our brothers nor fellow Christians, but simply children, women, old people. Feeling is aroused, and Russians go eagerly to help in stopping these atrocities. Fancy, if you were going along the street and saw drunken men beating a woman or a child, I imagine you would not stop to inquire whether war had been declared on the men, but would throw yourself on them and protect the victim. But I should not kill them, said Levin. Yes, you would kill them. I don't know. If I saw that, I might give way to my impulse of the moment, but I can't say beforehand. And such a momentary impulse there is not, and there cannot be, in the case of the oppression of the Slavonic peoples. Possibly for you there is not, but for others there is, said Sergei Ivanovich, frowning with displeasure. There are traditions still extant among our people about Orthodox men suffering under the yoke of the impious Agarites. The people have heard of the sufferings of their brethren and have spoken. Perhaps so, said Levin evasively, but I don't see it. I'm one of the people myself, and I don't feel it. Here am I, too, said the old prince. I've been staying abroad and reading the papers, and I must own, up to the time of the Bulgarian atrocities, I couldn't make out why it was all the Russians were all of a sudden so fond of their Slavonic brethren, while I didn't feel the slightest affection for them. I was very much upset, thought I was a monster, or that it was the influence of Carlsbad on me. But since I have been here, my mind's been set at rest. I see that there are people besides me who are only interested in Russia, and not in their Slavonic brethren. Here is Constantine, too. Personal opinions mean nothing in such a case, said Sergei Ivanovich. It's not a matter of personal opinions when all Russia, the whole people, has expressed its will. But excuse me, I don't see that. The people don't know anything about it, if you come to that, said the old prince. Oh, Papa, how can you say that? And last Sunday in church, said Dolly, listening to the conversation. Please give me a towel, she said to the old man, who was looking at the children with a smile. Why, it's not possible at all. But what was it in church on Sunday? The priest had been told to read that. He read it. They didn't understand a word of it. Sighed as they do at every sermon, pursued the old prince. Then they were told that there was to be a collection for a pious object in church. Well, they pulled out their coppers and gave them, but what for they couldn't say. The people cannot help knowing. The sense of their own destinies is always in the people, and at such moments as the present that sense finds utterance, said Sergei Ivanovich with conviction, glancing at the old beekeeper. The handsome old man with black grizzled beard and thick silvery hair stood motionless, holding a cup of honey, looking down from the height of his tall figure with friendly serenity at the gentlefolk, obviously understanding nothing of their conversation and not caring to understand it. That's so, no doubt, he said with a significant shake of his head at Sergei Ivanovich's words. Here, then, ask him. He knows nothing about it and thinks nothing, said Levin. Have you heard about the war, Mikhailich? He said, turning to him. What they read in the church? What do you think about it? Ought we to fight for the Christians? What should we think? Alexander Mikhailovich, our emperor has thought for us. He thinks for us indeed in all things. It's clearer for him to see. Shall I bring a bit more bread? Give the little lad some more, he said, addressing Darya Alexandrovna and pointing to Grisha, who was finishing his crust. I don't need to ask, said Sergei Ivanovich. We have seen and are seeing hundreds and hundreds of people who give up everything to serve a just cause, come from every part of Russia, and directly and clearly express their thought and aim. They bring their coppers or go themselves and say directly what's what. What does it mean? It means, to my thinking, said Levin, who was beginning to get warm, that among 80 millions of people there can always be found not hundreds, as now, but tens of thousands of people who have lost caste, ne'er-do-wells, who are always ready to go anywhere, to Pugachev's bands, to Kiva, to Serbia. I tell you that it's not a case of hundreds or of ne'er-do-wells, but the best representatives of the people, said Sergei Ivanovich, with as much irritation as if he were defending the last penny of his fortune. and what are the subscriptions? In this case, it is a whole people directly expressing their will. That word people is so vague, said Levin. Parish clerks, schoolmasters, and 1 in 1,000 of the peasants, maybe, know what it's all about. The rest of the 80 millions, like Mikhailich, far from expressing their will, haven't the faintest idea what there is for them to express their will about. What right have we to say that this is the people's will? Chapter 26. Sergei Ivanovich, being practiced in dialectics, did not reply, but at once turned the conversation to another aspect of the subject. Oh, if you want to learn the spirit of the people by arithmetical computation, of course it's very difficult to arrive at it. And voting has not been introduced among us, and cannot be introduced, for it does not express the will of the people. But there are other ways of reaching that. It is felt in the air, it is felt by the heart. I won't speak of those deep currents which are astir in the still ocean of the people, and which are evident to every unprejudiced man. Let us look at society in the narrow sense. All the most diverse sections of the intelligent people, hostile before, are merged in one. Every division is at an end. All the public organs say the same thing over and over again. All feel the mighty torrent that has overtaken them and is carrying them in one direction. Yes, all the newspapers do say the same thing, said the prince. That's true. But so it is the same thing that all the frogs croak before storm. One can hear nothing for them. Frogs or no frogs, I'm not the publisher of newspapers, and I don't want to defend them. But I am speaking of the unanimity in the intellectual world, said Sergei Ivanovich, addressing his brother. Levin would have answered, but the old prince interrupted him. Well, about that unanimity, that's another thing one may say, said the prince. There's my son-in-law, Stepan Arkadyevich. You know him. He's got a place now on the committee of a commission and something or other, I don't remember, only there's nothing to do in it. Why, golly, it's no secret, and a salary of 8,000. You try asking him whether his post is of any use. He'll prove to you that it's most necessary, and he's a truthful man, too, but one can't help but believe in the utility of 8,000 rubles. Yes, he asked me to give a message to Darya Alexandrovna about the post, said Sergei Ivanovich reluctantly, feeling the prince's remark to be ill-timed. So it is with the unanimity of the press. That's been explained to me. As soon as there's war, their incomes are doubled. How can they help believing in the destinies of the people and the Slavonic races and all that sort of thing? I don't care for many of the papers, but that's unjust, said Sergei Ivanovich. I would only make one condition, pursued the old prince. Alphonse Karr said a capital thing before the war in Prussia. You consider war to be inevitable. Very good. Let everyone who advocates war to be enrolled in a special regiment of advance guards, for the vanguard of every assault, of every attack, to lead them all. A nice lot the editors would make, said Katavasov, with a loud roar as he pictured the editors he knew in this picked legion. But they'd run, said Dolly. They'd only be in the way. Oh, if they ran away, then we'd have grape shot or Cossacks with whips behind them, said the prince. But that's a joke, and a poor one, too, if you'll excuse me saying so, prince, said Sergei Ivanovich. I don't see that it was a joke, that, Levin was beginning, but Sergei Ivanovich interrupted him. Every member of society is called upon to do his own special work, said he, and men of thought are doing their work when they express public opinion. And the single-hearted and full expression of public opinion is the service of the press, and a phenomenon to rejoice us at the same time. 20 years ago we should have been silent, but now we have heard the voice of the Russian people, which is ready to rise as one man and ready to sacrifice itself for its opposed brethren. That is a great step and a proof of strength. But it's not only making a sacrifice, but killing Turks, said Levin timidly. The people make sacrifices and are ready to make sacrifices for their soul, but not for murder, he added, instinctively connecting the conversation with the ideas that had been absorbing his mind. for their soul? That, you understand, is a most puzzling expression for a student of the natural sciences. What sort of thing is the soul? Said Katavasov, smiling. Oh, you know. No, by God, I haven't the faintest idea, said Katavasov with a loud roar of laughter. I bring not peace, but a sword, said Christ. Sergei Ivanovich rejoined for his part, quoting as simply as though it were the easiest thing to understand, the very passage that had always puzzled Levin most. That's so, no doubt, the old man repeated again. He was standing near them and responded to a chance glance turned in his direction. Ah, my dear fellow, you're defeated, utterly defeated, cried Katavasov good-humoredly. Levin reddened with vexation, not at being defeated, but at having failed to control himself and being drawn into argument. No, I can't argue with them, he thought. They wear impenetrable armor while I'm naked. He saw that it was impossible to convince his brother and Katavasov, and he saw even less possibility of himself agreeing with them. What they advocated was the very pride of intellect that had almost been his ruin. He could not admit that some dozens of men, among them his brother, had the right, on the ground of what they were told by some hundreds of glib volunteers swarming to the Capitol, to say that they and newspapers were expressing the will and feeling of the people, and a feeling which was expressed in vengeance and murder. He could not admit this, because he neither saw the expression of such feelings in the people among whom he was living, nor found them in himself, and he could not but consider himself one of the persons making up the Russian people. And most of all, because he, like the people, did not know and could not know what is for the general good, though he knew beyond a doubt that this general good could be attained only by the strict observance of that law of right and wrong, which has been revealed to every man, and therefore he could not wish for war or advocate war for any general objects whatever. He said, as Mikhailich did, and the people, who had expressed their feeling in the traditional invitations to the Viregi, be princes and rule over us. Gladly we promise complete submission. All the labor, all humiliations, all sacrifices we take upon ourselves, but we will not judge and decide. And now, according to Sergei Ivanovich's account, the people had forgone this privilege they had bought at such a costly price. He wanted to say, too, that if public opinion were an infallible guide, then why were not revolutions in the commune as lawful as the movement in favor of the Slavonic peoples? But these were merely thoughts that could settle nothing. One thing could be seen beyond doubt, that at the actual moment the discussion was irritating Sergei Ivanovich, and so it was wrong to continue it. And Levin ceased speaking and then called the attention of his guests to the fact that the storm clouds were gathering and that they had better be going home before it rained. Chapter 17. The old prince and Sergei Ivanovich got into the wagonette and drove off. The rest of the party hastened homeward on foot. But the storm clouds, turning white and then black, moved down so quickly that they had to quicken their pace to get home before the rain. The foremost clouds, lowering in black as soot-laden smoke, rushed with extraordinary swiftness over the sky. They were still 200 paces from home, and a gust of wind had already blown up, and every second the downpour might be looked for. The children ran ahead with frightened and gleeful shrieks. Darya Alexandrovna, struggling painfully with her skirts clinging round her legs, was not walking but running, her eyes fixed on the children. The men of the party, holding their hats on, strode with long steps beside her. They were just at the steps when a big drop fell splashing on the edge of the iron guttering. The children and their elders after them ran into the shelter of the house, talking merrily. Katerina Alexandrovna, Levin asked of Agatha Mikhailovna, who met them with shawls and plaids in the hall. We thought she was with you, she said. And Mitya? And Kolak he must be, and the nurse with him. Levin snatched up the plaids and ran toward the copse. In that brief interval of time, the storm clouds had moved on, covering the sun so completely that it was dark as an eclipse. Stubbornly, as though insisting on its rights, the wind stopped Levin, and tearing the leaves and flowers off the linden trees, and stripping the white birch branches into strange, unseemly nakedness, it twisted everything to one side, acacias, flowers, burdocks, long grass, and tall treetops. The peasant girls working in the garden ran shrieking into shelter in the servants' quarters. The streaming rain had already flung its white veil over all the distant forest and half the fields close by, and was rapidly swooping down upon the copse. The wet of the rain, spurting up in tiny drops, could be smelled in the air. Holding his head bent down before him and struggling with the wind that strove to tear the wraps away from him, Levin was moving up to the copse and had just caught sight of something white behind the oak tree when there was a sudden flash. The whole earth seemed on fire, and the vault of heaven seemed crashing overhead. Opening his blinded eyes, Levin gazed through the thick veil of rain that separated him now from the copse, and to his horror, the first thing he saw was the green crest of the familiar oak tree in the middle of the copse, uncannily changing its position. Can it have been struck? Levin hardly had time to think when, moving more and more rapidly, the oak tree vanished behind the other trees, and he heard the crash of the great tree falling upon the others. The flash of lightning, the crash of thunder, and the instantaneous chill that ran through him were all merged for Levin in one sense of terror. "My God, my God, not on them," he said. And though he thought at once how senseless was his prayer that they should not have been killed by the oak which had fallen now, he repeated it, knowing that he could do nothing better than utter this senseless prayer. Running up to the place where they usually went, he did not find them there. They were at the other end of the copse, under an old linden tree. They were calling him. Two figures in dark dresses, they had been light summer dresses when they started out, were standing bending over something. It was Kitty, with the nurse. The rain was already ceasing, and it was beginning to get light when Levin reached them. The nurse was not wet on the lower part of her dress, but Kitty was drenched through, and her soaked clothes clung to her. Though the rain was over, they still stood in the same position in which they had been standing when the storm broke. Both stood bending over a perambulator with a green umbrella. "Alive, unhurt, thank God," he said, splashing with his soaked boots through the standing water and running up to them. Kitty's rosy, wet face was turned toward him, and she smiled timidly under her shapeless, sopping hat. "Aren't you ashamed of yourself? I can't think how you can be so reckless," he said angrily to his wife. "It wasn't my fault, really. We were just intending to go when he made such a to-do that we had to change him. We were just..." Kitty began defending herself. Mitya was unharmed, dry, and still fast asleep. "Well, thank God. I don't know what I'm saying." They gathered up the baby's wet belongings. The nurse picked up the baby and carried it. Levin walked beside his wife, and penitent for having been angry, he squeezed her hand when the nurse was not looking. Chapter 18. During the whole of that day, in the extremely varied conversations in which he took part, only as it were with the top layer of his mind, in spite of the disappointment of not finding the change he expected in himself, Levin had been all the while joyfully conscious of the fullness of his heart. After the rain, it was too wet to go for a walk. Besides, the storm clouds still hung about the horizon and gathered here and there, black and thundery, on the rim of the sky. The whole party spent the rest of the day in the house. No more discussions sprang up. On the contrary, after dinner, everyone was in the most amiable frame of mind. At first, Katavasov amused the ladies by his original jokes, which always pleased people on their first acquaintance with him. Then Sergei Ivanovich induced him to tell him about the very interesting observations he had made on the difference between the female and male common houseflies in their characteristics and their physiognomies and their frame of life. Sergei Ivanovich, too, was in good spirits, and at tea his brother drew him on to explain his views of the future of the Eastern question, and he spoke so simply and so well that everyone listened eagerly. Kitty was the only one who did not hear at all. She was summoned to give Mitya his bath. A few minutes after Kitty had left the room, she sent for Levin to come to the nursery. Leaving his tea and regretfully interrupting the interesting conversation, and at the same time uneasily wondering why he had been sent for, as this only happened on important occasions, Levin went to the nursery. Although he had been much interested by Sergei Ivanovich's views of the new epoch in history that would be created by the emancipation of 40 millions of men of Slavonic race acting with Russia, a conception quite new to him, and although he was disturbed by uneasy wonder at being sent for by Kitty, as soon as he came out of the drawing room and was alone, his mind reverted at once to the thoughts of the morning, and all the theories of the significance of the Slav element in the history of the world seemed to him so trivial compared with what was passing in his own soul that he instantly forgot it all and dropped back into the same frame of mind that he had been in that morning. He did not, as he had done at other times, recall the whole train of thought. That was not necessary for him. He fell back at once into the feeling which had guided him, which was connected with those thoughts, and he found that feeling in his soul even stronger and more definite than before. He did not, as he had had to do with previous attempts to find comforting arguments, need to revive a whole chain of thought to find the feeling. Now, on the contrary, the feeling of joy and peace was keener than ever, and thought could not keep pace with feeling. He walked across the terrace and looked at two stars that had come out in the darkening sky, and suddenly he remembered. Yes, looking at the sky, I thought that the dome that I see is not a deception. And then I did not think over something to the last. I shirked facing something, he mused, but whatever it was, there can be no disproving it. I have but to think, and all will come clear. Just as he was going into the nursery, he remembered what it was he had shirked facing. It was that if the chief proof of the divinity was his revelation of what is right, how is it this revelation is confined to the Christian church alone? What relation to this revelation have the beliefs of the Buddhist Mohammedans who preached and did good too? It seemed to him that he had an answer to this question, but he had not time to formulate it to himself before he went into the nursery. Kitty was standing with her sleeves tucked up over the baby in the bath. Hearing her husband's footsteps, she turned toward him, summoning him to her with her smile. With one hand, she was supporting the fat baby that lay floating and sprawling on its back, while with the other, she squeezed the sponge over him. "Come, look, look," she said when her husband came up to her. "Agatha Mikhailovna's right. He knows us." Mitya had on that day given unmistakable, incontestable signs of recognizing all his friends. As soon as Levin approached the bath, the experiment was tried, and it was completely successful. The cook, sent for with this object, bent over the baby. He frowned and shook his head disapprovingly. Kitty bent down to him. He gave her a beaming smile, propped his little hands on the sponge and chirped, making such a queer little contented sound with his lips that Kitty and the nurse were not alone in their admiration. Levin, too, was surprised and delighted. The baby was taken out of the bath, drenched with water, wrapped in towels, dried, and after a piercing scream, handed to his mother. "Well, I am glad you are beginning to love him," said Kitty to her husband when she had settled herself comfortably in her usual place with the baby at her breast. "I am so glad. It had begun to distress me. You said you had no feeling for him." "No. Did I say that? I only said I was disappointed." "What? Disappointed in him?" "Not disappointed in him, but in my own feeling. I had expected more. I had expected a rush of new delightful emotion to come as a surprise. And then instead of that, disgust, pity." She listened attentively, looking at him over the baby, while she put back on her slender fingers the rings she had taken off while giving Mitya his bath. "And most of all, at there being far more apprehension and pity than pleasure. Today, after that fright during the storm, I understand how I love him." Kitty's smile was radiant. "Were you very much frightened?" she said. "So was I, too. But I feel it more now that it's over. I'm going to look at the oak. How charming Katavasov is. And what a happy day we've had together. And you're so amiable with Sergei Ivanovich, when you care to be. Well, go back to them. It's always so hot and steamy here after the bath." Chapter 19. Going out of the nursery and being alone again, Levin went back at once to the thought in which there was something not clear. Instead of going into the drawing room where he heard voices, he stopped on the terrace, and leaning his elbows on the parapet, he gazed up at the sky. It was quite dark now, and in the south, where he was looking, there were no clouds. The storm had drifted on to the opposite side of the sky, and there were flashes of lightning and distant thunder from that quarter. Levin listened to the monotonous drip from the linden trees in the garden and looked at the triangle of stars he knew so well and the Milky Way with its branches that ran through its midst. At each flash of lightning, the Milky Way and even the bright stars vanished, but as soon as the lightning died away, they reappeared in their places as though some hand had flung them back with careful aim. "Well, what is it that perplexes me?" Levin said to himself, feeling beforehand that the solution of his difficulties was ready in his soul, though he did not know it yet. Yes, the one unmistakable, incontestable manifestation of the divinity is the law of right and wrong, which has come into the world by revelation, and which I feel within myself, and in the recognition of which I not so much make myself, but, willy-nilly, am made, one with other men in one body of believers, which is called the Church. Well, but the Jews, the Mohammedans, the Confucians, the Buddhists, what of them? He put to himself the question he had feared to face. Can these hundreds of millions of men be deprived of that highest blessing without which life has no meaning? He pondered a moment, but immediately corrected himself. But what am I questioning? He said to himself. I am questioning the relation to divinity of all the different religions of all mankind. I am questioning the universal manifestation of God to all the world with all these nebulae. What am I about? To me individually, to my heart, has been revealed a knowledge beyond all doubt and unattainable by all reason. And here I am obstinately trying to express that knowledge in reason and words. Don't I know that the stars don't move? He asked himself, gazing at the brightest planet, which had shifted its position up to the topmost twig of a birch tree. But looking at the movements of the stars, I can't picture to myself the rotation of the earth. And I'm right in saying that the stars move. And could the astronomers have understood and calculated anything if they had taken into account all the complicated and varied motions of the earth, all the marvelous conclusions they have reached about the distances, weights, revolutions, and perturbations of the heavenly bodies, are only founded on the apparent motions of the heavenly bodies round the stationary earth, on that very motion I see before me now, which has been so for millions of men during long ages, has been and always will be alike, and can always be verified. And just as the conclusions of the astronomers would have been vain and uncertain if not founded on observations of the visible heavens, in relation to a single meridian and a single horizon, so would my conclusions be vain and uncertain if not founded on that conception of right, which has been and will always be alike for all men, which has been revealed to me by Christianity, and which can always be verified in my soul. The question of other religions and their relations to divinity, I have no right to decide, and no possibility of deciding. Oh, you haven't gone in then, he heard Kitty's voice suddenly as she came by the same way to the drawing room. What is it? You're not worried about anything, she said, looking intently at his face in the starlight. Not hidden the stars and revealed it. In that flash, she saw his face distinctly, and seeing him calm and happy, she smiled at him. She understands, he thought. She knows what I'm thinking about. Shall I tell her or not? Yes, I'll tell her. But at the moment he was about to speak, she began speaking. Kostya, do something for me, she said. Go into the corner room and see if they've made it ready for Sergei Ivanovich. I can't very well. See if they've put the new washstand in it. Very well, I'll go directly, said Levin, standing up and kissing her. No, I'd better not speak of it, he thought, when she had gone in before him. It is a secret for me alone, of vital importance for me, and not to be put into words. This new feeling has not changed me, has not made me happy and enlightened all of a sudden, as I had dreamed, just like the feeling for my child. There was no surprise in this either. Whether it is faith or not, I don't know what it is, but this feeling has come just as imperceptibly through suffering and has taken firm root in my soul. I shall go on in the same way, losing my temper with Ivan the coachman, falling into angry discussions, expressing my opinions tactlessly. there will be still the same wall between the Holy of Holies of my soul and other people, even my wife. I shall still go on scolding her for my own fright and being remorseful for it. I shall still be as unable to understand with my reason why I pray, and I shall still go on praying. But my life now, my whole life, apart from anything that can happen to me, every minute of it is no more meaningless as it was before, but it has the positive meaning of goodness, which I have the power to put into it. The end.